From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading creators, writers, and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we're bringing you discussions with creative teams behind two hit comedy series. Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch will discuss their Netflix series, Glow, which chronicles the lives of the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, a 1980s women's wrestling circuit.
It's ultimately a story of a team. We try never to lose sight of that, and whenever we kind of break off, it's for a reason that hopefully is feeding the larger stories.
And later, creators Aileen Brosh McKenna and Rachel Bloom join filmmaker Katie Hyde to discuss the musical comedy series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and the documentary Oh My God, I Think It's Over, which chronicled the creation of the final season.
We wanted to do a big, long, kind of sweeping Rebecca Bunch epic. Young women deserve that much of a big 60-episode journey, and that's what she got.
On Story from Austin Film Festival. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's script and film competitions are currently accepting submissions. All script entrants receive free readers' comments, and advancing writers will be afforded exclusive panels, workshops, and networking opportunities at Austin Film Festival's annual Writers' Conference each October. For more information on badges, passes, or to submit, visit www.austinfilmfestival.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. The Netflix series Glow tells the story of a 1980s crew of female misfits who reinvent themselves as the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. The series is a fictionalized version of a real women's professional wrestling promotion, which hosted shows from 1986 to 1992. The series was created by Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch, who started their writing careers as playwrights. I spoke with Liz and Carly at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Glow, courtesy of Netflix.
I'm a huge fan of the show, and we showed Gorgeous Lady of Wrestling's documentary. So I would love to hear how you, who are both essentially with playwright backgrounds and obviously other television credits, but how you got to Glow, like how this became something that you thought, yeah, we could develop that into a series.
We were both in a writer's room together, Nurse Jackie, where Liz had been there the entire time. Liz brought me on at the end. We were never a writing team. We were two playwrights working in TV who happened to work really, really well together in the writer's room. But there was a definite kind of falling in love in a writer's room. And then towards the end, you know, conversations about we should find something, we should do something together. And I think we had a hunch it would be female-centric, as everything we had worked on seemed to be about women. And that's where we were happy. But then Liz was, I feel like you were home with a
Yeah, I had my second kid.
She was home with a newborn.
Nightmare. And so I was just like, please come over, please. And so Carly was just like hunting around for stuff while I was dealing with like a screaming newborn.
And I'm a docufile, so I was just watching my usual slate of documentaries. I saw that doc, and something about the world just felt so rich and so both in, you know, it's a bananas, cartoony, good and evil take on the 80s, but also there was so much about that doc, I don't know who's seen it, that almost feels like a League of Their Own style was even more about the women looking back on this time in their life at something that kind of, to outsiders, looked like a blip on the pop cultural radar, but for them was some of the most meaningful time in their entire lives. So I brought it to Liz, we watched it, and then I think it was literally a one-line email to Jenji Kohan, who I had worked on both Weeds and Orange is the New Black. I think the email was literally, do you want to make a TV show about women's wrestling in the 80s? And she literally wrote back, yes. That was, then it took a full year to get from that email to a script.
It was not like there were three drafts. There were many, many drafts. Like at first we're like, they're sisters. We're like, they're not sisters. Like it's just, there were so many versions. It's funny, like I looked back recently just at sort of our initial conversations when we were writing the pilot. And we would do this thing that I think was unintentional, but just as we were trying to figure out how to work with each other, where we would just email back and forth about sort of what we wanted the show to be. And it wasn't to create a pitch document, it was just to like get our hands around what we wanted to say and what we wanted to do. And a lot of those sort of foundational like emails between us, like you look back and you're like, oh yeah, like we're like, we want it to be like, ugly and desperate, but like incredibly beautiful. And this has to be about like a team of women with a friendship at the core.
So I want to talk about that pilot, and it's actually still one of my favorite episodes, because you're talking about this strong friendship that not just these women have, all these women have. And yet that first episode is the seed of the whole show, built on betrayal. And that part, how they worked through that and how it is the impetus for the entire group to get together successfully. Can you talk about like where that concept came from and you know, how you figured that that would be a way to draw out more episodes from that?
I think at first we were like, how much wrestling do we really need in a show about wrestling? And then I think the answer to that question was like a lot, ideally, and in a meaningful way. And I think once we sort of got into the, you know, just we wanted it to feel really layered, and how you were going to watch it wasn't just surface. It would be watching these women working through things in their actual life in the ring in a very particular way. And I think once we sort of cracked that in the first episode, which took a long time, and figuring out sort of like, how do you introduce the idea of like the show? How do you see the show without seeing the show? Like, how do you show the audience and I think Sam glow without actually having made any of the show within a show? So I think it, I mean, it took us a long time to get to the, you know, the fantasy pop, the idea that like you were gonna take this like very real, super emotional, like one of our most dramatic scenes in the pilot scenes, and then transition gracefully into like a bonkers, you know, Allie and Betty circling each other as like, you know, the beginning seeds of like their characters, where you see who plays the heel and who plays the hero. So,
but even Sam in that episode is really used beautifully to be almost like a wasp. You know, he's like circling around trying to sting them, you know, making something bigger than it was. You know, was that something that you envisioned originally in the pilot, or does some of that have to do with, I mean, Marc Maron is Marc Maron, you know, so does some of it have to do with what he brings to it? Did that expand his character in any way?
I mean, he'll say it too. I think it's the thing that's so funny is everyone's like, did you write it for Marc? We're like, nope. Like, we did not. They sent us a tape. We watched it. We were like, at first I was like, Marc Maron's auditioning for Glow. And then I watched it. I was like, oh, he's, there we go. Like, there's the guy. But he, you know, he was very particular about like not improvising at all. So, I mean, that character is like, that's word for word, you know, what we wrote. And I think it just fits him like a glove. And it's sort of the beauty of, you know, and I think then we got incredibly lucky, and also like really thought about like what we were seeing as we were shooting, like just the amount of just sort of spark that he has, like when he goes at Allie, which is one of our favorite things ultimately to write.
Look at this. She doesn't care about anyone but herself. She's gonna destroy lives, even tiny lives that haven't started yet. You're a horrible person and you don't deserve to live.
I think I deserve to live.
Hey, Uta Hagen, all right, just take some direction for a minute, all right? Is that too much to ask? It's not about you. I'm trying to see if the skit works. Now circle the other one. Okay, good. Okay, stir. Oh. Let's work on your side. Because if there's one thing I learned in my illustrious career is that you can't rely on a blood ring to sell a performance.
So can you talk about that process of casting that show? And, you know, I'm sure there was a casting agent, but in your looking at people to determine, were they right?
You know, a lot of how we talked about the show initially was that we wanted it to be a body show. It's a show about bodies, women's bodies. And so we should see all body types. And then also, you know, we said to people, this is going to sound insane, but we want all the women to do their own wrestling.
And there were people who definitely didn't want to do that.
And then, you know, probably like 80% of the people dropped out of wanting to be on the show. and the people who were left were the kind of game, you know, glow-spirited people.
You know, we had a lot of freedom in who we cast, you know, frankly. Like, Netflix did not, as they don't with many things, like, they did not get in our way. We said who we wanted, and we got who we wanted, and we were the ones who sort of had to duke it out when we didn't feel like we were there. Like, we weren't fighting with a network. We were fighting it out with each other.
It was the opposite. We were like, is Allie Bree too much of a star to play Ruth?
Is she just too pretty and capable?
Betty is someone we knew from the theater world, and then she was on Nurse Jackie. Yeah. And I think even before we wrote the script, we were like, Betty belongs in this world somewhere. We'll figure out where. But she is somebody who, especially back then, felt a bit undiscovered, wrongly undiscovered for us, and somebody who was so judged by her looks that no one realized she was the smartest, weirdest person in the room at all times. So yes, there were some people we brought Gail Rankin to, who plays Sheila, we knew from theater, and we were like, another person that we're like,
you've no, nobody has any idea.
We will put her somewhere. Yeah. And then when she auditioned for Sheila, we're like, well, that was the most emotionally grounded performance of a wolf lady I've ever seen. We wrote that monologue as a kind of absurdist lark, and she just made us all cry. So I guess,
I guess that's what we're doing with that character.
I guess
now.
She gets her.
I've worn this, or some version of this, every day for the past 5 years. It's not a costume. Just me. And what I do in the morning. What I put on, what I wear. It's not for you. It is for me.
I get it. I think.
In the first season, there was so much of the girls sort of getting used to each other. Like, they were really kind of feeling it out, and who is who, and who's going to be friends with who, and who are we. And now, by the end of season three, we're very much getting these individual characters on their own, and we're getting to spend some time with them and learn more about them. You know, can you talk about that development process over the three seasons?
I mean, our goal is by the end of the series to have kind of gotten to know each and every one of those women. But we are kind of going at our own pace as we do that, so that it's not kind of dictating the shape or the story, just because it's ultimately a story of a team. It's a story of a group of women. So like, we try never to lose sight of that. And whenever we kind of break off, it's for a reason that hopefully is feeding the larger story, as opposed to kind of like, and now a detour with. And when you only have 10 episodes too, it feels, you have to be so precious with them.
And I think sort of like the like rebellion of the show for us is the idea of like how many times we put 14 or 15 women in a frame together, because frankly, it is not something you see all that often still, even though we're in like a better moment. You know, I think you look at so many casts and it is like many, many men and two women, and we are the opposite. And I love that we're the opposite. And I think there's something about that that feels like it is the team is the beating heart of the show. And how that team, you know, works on you and tells our story is a big part of it.
Well, and yet you've given a lot of space to Sam and Bash. Mm-hmm. You know, they both have become very, they're not like just token.
No, they're really important characters. I mean, it's more the sort of balance of, you know, and I think that's the thing. Like, there are many wonderful shows where it's a lot of men and two wonderful female characters. We're just flipping that. And they're narratively incredibly important. And I think there is that thing for us where we're like, oh, we're still telling a story of making something in the mid-80s. Yeah. And they're, you know, and there are male producers and male directors, and they hold a seat of power that is part of our story. Yeah. So they're not incidental in any way.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with GLOW creators Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch. The pair previously wrote for Orange is the New Black, Nurse Jackie, and Weeds.
I keep waiting for you to completely abandon that documentary, but you haven't. I mean, it's clear you're not following the documentary, but you've also kind of stayed true to the women in the original documentary.
The characters are our own, and they're on their own journeys, and with each season we get further and further even from anything close to the documentary. But I think that that kind of foundational inspiration, which is that this should be both stupid and silly and the most meaningful pocket of time in their lives, and some of them may never work again, and some of them may never speak again, but for the however long our show is on, they're a unit, I think, is important as a touchstone. And I think, you know, look, I've written in the kind of Jenji Kohan camp for a while of like, if you're creatively bored, you burn it down and you move somewhere else. And I think that's really freeing, exciting, and it's emboldened us to even do things like, whatever, sometimes we move the show to Vegas.
Live from the Fantan Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, it's GLOW, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling! Yes, yes, yes! What an audience tonight! Wow, so many VIPs! Better bust out the bubbly!
But whenever you pull moves like that, the thing that keeps you kind of true to your own show is like having a few foundational things that, like, no matter how off course it seems like you may be from your premise, you're actually not very far at all from the kind of wellspring of why you're making the show and what the kind of larger ambition is. And I think on that level, yes, we are very kind of true to the original, the spirit of it. And in other ways, we're, one of our cast members, Kia Stevens, is a pro wrestler. And those stories, and as well as a lot of the original GLOW girls, like, there are some real rough stories in there. It's a hard life. There are bodies that don't work. There's a lot of, in any group.
There's a lot of exploitation. It's a real journeyman.
There's addiction. Yeah. There are a lot of original stories that we're also not touching.
You okay?
I'm fine. It's just a muscle spasm.
How long have you been in pain?
Around this morning.
How long? Do not lie to me.
It's only 4 more shows. Don't worry about me. I'll make it.
And she's down yet again. Wow.
That's your cue. Don't worry about me. Go get on the zip line.
Again, like, we're true to the spirit of how the experience felt, but I think we're very much like honoring some different people's experiences within that.
So another thing I think, especially now this last season, that has been interesting to me is how you've woven lots of current conversations into it, and yet they don't really feel, sometimes that makes me crazy, that when they're like, okay, they weren't talking about that then, but pretty much everything that we're talking about now, we were talking about then.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it maybe a little bit differently, but it was definitely the conversation, everything from, homosexuality to immigration to whatever, and you've managed to weave all those things in very realistically. Can you talk about how you did that this season and how you really approached it with your writer's room?
I think it's definitely things we talk about a lot. I think there are a couple things to say. I mean, one is that we're research nerds and we go real deep on the research, which has been awesome. Like, I feel like it'll be sad when GLOW ends just because it's so fun and it's such a rich time to dig into. And we make that part of the room. We did a research trip to Vegas, which really was a research trip to Vegas. Like, we did not... We did, like, the writers were like, we're going to Vegas. I'm like, we're going to talk to a historian, and we're going to go on this tour, and we're going to go backstage here and talk to these people. And they're like, when are we going to get
showgirl
drunk?
Showgirl Museum.
Yeah, Showgirl Museum. It was very, very
not
dry.
A lot of people go to the museum side of the showgirl story.
But I think it's that thing where how much you get from just speaking to people directly, and, we reach out to... when we don't know, when we know we want to attack something that feels like it's coursing through our culture now, you know, we do look back and really want to know sort of how it was being dealt with then. And we have modern brains, but I think we never want to pull you out of, you know, the sort of reality of the time to say something important. So I think it's really doing a ton of homework. Even if it's just for like a couple little details, it's getting as much as you can about, you know, I think we talked to the guy who's in charge of the queer archives at UNLV. We read an oral history that he had done that was never published about this guy, Kenny Kerr, who was a female impersonator, a drag performer. And so like things like that, it felt like 100 pages of reading for like some really great foundational understanding of what was actually going on.
But it is a tightrope. Like we're trying to avoid we never want the show to feel like a museum piece. We're not people who kind of, you know, there are people who do like that. We're not kind of into just watching something. But at the same time, yes, we don't want to kind of do a revisionist history of what the 80s were. And I think that like season 2, episode 5, which is an episode where Ruth and, you know, a network exec kind of have an almost Me Too incident. And then, you know, so much of that episode for us, we've been asked about it a lot, was about the conversation between Ruth and Debbie afterwards, not about what actually happened in the room with Ruth and the network exec. And what was so exciting about it was Debbie says some really retrograde things. And that was kind of, for us, the power of the scene, that everything Debbie said was completely
true for her.
True for her. And yeah, I think you would hear it less today, even though maybe some people are still thinking it.
You're in the hotel room of the head of the network. He comes on to you and you run away? Was I supposed to f*** him? No, you're supposed to make him think that you might f*** him. Or that you desperately want to f*** him, if only you didn't have a fiance or your period or an extra set of teeth where your f*** should be.
I'm not that kind of person.
What, an actress? I mean, that is how this business works. Ruth, men try. You have to pretend to like it until you don't have to anymore.
It shouldn't be that way.
No, it shouldn't. And women should get to direct and not be washed up by the time they're 30. And I should have gotten to eat a piece of my own wedding cake without worrying about how many minutes of Jane Fonda was going to take to work it off. But that is the way it is.
For us, we're always trying to think like, it's not about the event or the incident. It's about like how our women are processing it or talking about it. So it's scenes like that that get us excited.
I mean, you've been hinting about Bash's character.
Yeah.
And I mean, his clearly fighting against this epiphany. I love the way you've woven it into so many different things, because his character feels to me to be very real. So can you talk about how, you know, like what the process is essentially, not just of him, but Wolf Girl as well. What was your plan in season 1 to ultimately reveal some things for us in season 3? And those two have had huge revelations, right?
Yeah. There are certain characters, and I think you just named like the primary two, that I think we could be fully open that like we're not as fully fleshed out at the beginning. Just when you have that many characters, I think there are certain that you use a little shorthand for. And I think also Sam, I think, you know, some of our early notes were just a misogynist in the middle of a world of women. And for Bash, you know, it was like a wealthy playboy, son of a Republican who loves wrestling. And, you know, we're people who are humanists, so we're like, well, eventually we'll get there. But, you know, when Chris Lowell, who is an actor that we have loved, I saw him in a play at Ars Nova called Jacuzzi and was like, that guy's the guy. And Chris himself admits, he was like, when I read it and then when you guys talked to me about the character, I was a little like, okay, I guess I gotta trust you.
Like, we're like, it's deep, it's gonna go these places, then we're like, episode 3, your helicopter takes everyone to Malibu.
Yeah.
We have
we're
a like, party and there are costumes.
Enter like, via helicopter. Yeah. We swear it's a super grounded show.
Now, why don't you go let this lady know that there's a costume closet on the second floor?
You guys! Costume party, get naked!
Now this, I can get used to.
Play around, try on anything, okay? Maybe these could help inspire you in your wrestling personas.
Ooh.
That's right. Your wrestling personas.
And would Madame Xenothrob, the slaver pimp, wear fur?
Is that what the first telling you? Go with what feels right.
But his character, yeah, you know, again, there's a responsibility to telling stories about gay characters in the 80s, and I think that has also guided us on some level, and the kind of inherent tension of having that identity and being in a kind of conservative family felt really exciting to us. And then I think some of the other things that have been really helpful is so much of the show is about how people see you. That's what wrestling, you know, wrestling is kind of about the stereotype or the way people see you and then who you really are. So I think making sure we honored that for our men and then kind of slowly, slowly teasing out Bash's identity in a way that, you know, I think season one, maybe the furthest we got was like he put on glitter eyeshadow. That was like, that was the furthest we got, even though Chris was like, really subtly playing things that if you look back as early as season one, Chris uses every opportunity when he's in a scene with Mark and a man to touch him. Just small. It's so small, but
he
Chris
doesn't do it with the women. But
he nope, he never like, touches.
Like,
We do a thing with our actors every season, and even like we don't start the season with all our scripts written or anything, but we talk to them about our plan for the season, so they really know going in where we're headed.
Yeah.
With every single actor on our show, we have a meeting, we sit down, we're like, this is the season shape, this is where we want to get to, these are the things that your character's going to sort of go through if you want to know. It really helps, because I think that in that we have a plan and sort of they know what they're hooking into, you get all these beautiful, very informed choices. And I think like we, you know, we rack up a lot of trust and we're very hands-on and we're on set and, you know, we know what's going on with our people. But I do think taking the time in the room to really know where we're, like every once in a while we fly by the seat of our pants because like we're always gonna at some point in the season, because we're like, we don't know, it's gonna be great, but we're not sure about what happens right at the end. But I do think it helps get these things that you wouldn't otherwise have gotten from the performers.
So how do you balance these really incredibly overdramatic moments, like way beyond, and then you take us back to something, you know, that's very much purely character-driven and emotional. So how are those discussions, again, in the writer's room? Because that is, I would think, a balancing act in each script that's written. You
know? I mean, I think it, again, like, starts from, like, the toggle is the fun and the toggle is the challenge, right? Like, there's something, and I think finding writers and finding actors and finding directors who are comfortable playing in both sandboxes. I mean, Betty, I think part of the inspiration for casting somebody like Betty is that she makes big, big faces and big theatrical choices and then can, like, kill you dead with totally grounded emotional scene. And I feel like that is sort of the spirit of the show. It's sort of like bonkers, play to the rafters, and then kick you in the stomach.
Characters should always be active. Things should always be causing other things. We like to make sure every episode has its own kind of like magic sprinkled in. We like to make sure that if we're following one character, if you don't watch the next episode, we've kind of given you a satisfying story within that episode.
I mean, I think also like when we, I think another thing is in terms of it being the story of the team, we're like, oh, if we leave the team a little bit for an episode, we don't, we have to come back to them. You know, I think that's a sort of, in terms of a structural rule.
And then to say, like, you have to be extremely open-minded and ruthless at the same time in editing.
I mean, some of my favorite scenes are in the ring. They're always, I mean, I just...
The ring's great, man.
We write most of them, but then there are a few that there's just kind of, like, some kind of magical things. I think season one, episode seven, there's a wrestling montage where Ruth and Debbie learn how to work together.
So do I grab on to a specific body part?
Sort of grab everything and fall backwards.
You're not gonna drop me, right?
No, I swear. Got you.
It's a trust fall. And I have to stare at your face and remember all the reasons I don't trust you.
Look, if you miss, my body will break the fall. I'll take the hit.
Okay.
Yes! Ah!
How'd that look?
So great.
Let's do it again.
Jesse Peretz directed, and there was something just about the combination of like how we were talking about that sequence, and there was a kind of, Jesse's one of those directors who's like, well, just punk rock it, let's bring like five leotards with us to a location and we'll just, let's just overshoot. And that's one of those ones where I'm sure this montage was like four lines in the script, you know, and it's one of the most glorious pieces of filmmaking in, I think, the show and in that episode.
Although, but anytime you put the Russian in the U.S., I mean, that's just such a brilliant way to...
It's the bad guy of the 80s. Yeah. It feels like you can't, you know, so much of wrestling, again, we learned was like, oh, yeah, it's really just a kind of really a lens into the fears and the prejudices of a time period. And what's fun about the 80s are the prejudices and fears are quite clear. Yeah. Like Welfare Queen felt so wrong and so offensive, but then you're like, that's the boogeyman. Like, it's at least for the heels, there's a kind of like sorting, an easy sorting.
But I do think it was like for you, when like Carly, you watched Rocky IV for the first time, like while we were writing season one, you were like, oh my God,
yeah.
This is America versus, it's amazing. And yeah. I was like, oh yeah.
I'll fight you.
Who's that? Who's yelling from the audience?
You heard me. I said, I'll fight you. Oh, you? Bored housewife in dress?
Yeah. I am a proud American mother.
No way she was speaking.
Did you know? No, of course not. I would have told you. In a world without freedom. And I'm ready to kick your Soviet ass all the way back to Siberia.
Look at this brave American.
Can we just hold this? If this is too silly for you, you can leave.
And then you would talk to people and they'd be like, I think in around 85, yeah, I wasn't even sure why we didn't like Russians anymore. Which was, again, helpful, because you're like, you have to think about it from Ruth's perspective. She's playing a character, and she doesn't even really understand the Cold War.
Yeah. So what are the challenges of taking this one-dimensional art form into yours?
Our joke is that instead of the challenges, it's almost like the bar was so low for us. You know, people expected a stupid, cheesy show from us. You know, like, even that one-sentence email to Genji, which is like, do you want to make a show about women's wrestlers in the 80s? Like, we didn't add, like, that will be super nuanced and we'll flesh everyone out. We could only surprise you in a positive way if it turned out there was more there and you cared about the people. Yeah. But
then when we talked about thinking about that and then thinking about making the show within a show, the thing that was really inspiring was just how janky we wanted to be in terms of like the production values when we saw the show within a show and how inspiring that was and how you could actually tell the story of people like trying to make something, which, and I think just characters trying and like falling down and like getting back up is like my favorite thing to watch and write. So I do think there's something about the idea of sort of the fight to make something and be like creatively alive and like viable is like, it's, you know, a story of a bunch of people fundamentally trying to be artists and just watching them make this thing that, you know, when you actually see what they're making, like we've had all these like very meaningful stories.
If other people made Glow, I'm sure there's a not three-dimensional version of it that would be some insane sitcom that would also be probably delightful in other ways. But we're people who are, you know, we're not writing a show about Zoya the Destroyer, we're writing a show about Ruth trying to play the character Zoya the Destroyer standing in a ring, not with Liberty Bell, but with her best friend Debbie, whose husband she slept with, who's also grappling with a bunch of as she tries to play Liberty Bell. So that kind of always brings you back to the people, and then I think you're starting in the right place when you're not like, okay, Russians versus Americans in the ring. You're kind of like, okay, that was the idea. Step back. Follow the people.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival will be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was a musical comedy series that ran for 4 seasons on the CW. Throughout its run, the musical received praise from critics and fans for its realistic depictions of mental illness and sexuality. The series co-creators, Aileen Brosh McKenna and Rachel Bloom, joined filmmaker Katie Hyde and screenwriter Pamela Ribbon at the Austin Film Festival. They discussed the series and Hyde's documentary, Oh My God, I Think It's Over, which gave viewers a behind-the-scenes look at the creation of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend's final season. Clips of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, courtesy of CBS Studios, Inc., and Warner Brothers Entertainment, Inc., and the CW Network.
I'm going to open up for questions very, very quickly, but I wanted to ask, there's such a theme of love and trust that comes out of this, that it's what permeates through the entire series. How do you think you found that trust and love early on within your cast and crew?
I think from the beginning, the show was always meant to be a deconstruction of stereotypes and looking at characters from the inside out, and the whole show really was about showing empathy for those characters, and so I think that that philosophy of empathy, I think, radiated outward.
I also think we're two women who just instinctively we formed a tight friendship, even though we just started working together. It was just inevitably we got closer and closer over the process because we really did start working the second we met. But over that time, you know, we developed a friendship while we were working. And it's interesting because I, at the end, when I toast Rachel and I say my muse, my whatever, and I didn't say partner, and I'm looking at that now and I realized it was because I had spent that finale with her as my leading lady and the writing had been over for a while. But we were partners in every sense of it. And it was, you know, we had to, that meant that there were many times when we were finishing each other's sentences, and then many times where we were like trying to explain to each other why we disagreed on stuff. But as you can see, we were trying to do that while sprinting. So it was the trying to collaborate in this environment of intense work. Rachel and I worked really hard to develop a system of trust and ways to connect with each other. And I think that people on this show saw that like we would try and make sure that we were both heard. And it was hard. It was really difficult to do. So that was the atmosphere that we were trying to create. But it was also because we needed to be able to listen to each other in all the chaos.
Katie, how did you end up being part of that circle of trust and bringing in your own crew on top of that? How did you become invisible?
Aileen and I have a long history together, so I think that trust was already there for me to be able to come in moments where they were still developing things.
She has many shots where I'm like, not now, Katie, not now, not now, Katie.
Yeah. I was definitely pushed out of some rooms. But I think, just being there for the whole process was key.
You know, there's such a wonderful range of genre and songs, and I have to imagine that there are some wish list songs or genres that
There isn't, because it would be like if you said to a writer, like, have you always wanted to do a scene on a boat? Like, you don't really, you know, does that make sense?
Yes.
It was all driven by the material. So it was kind of, although once in a while there would be a genre that we really loved and wanted to do and somebody would be advocating for. And I had been advocating for New Jack Swing since the beginning. We ended up doing a song called Don't Be a Lawyer, which is that.
So you're just gonna throw away all those years of law school, all that time studying for the bar, all that time taking the bar?
I know the process to become a lawyer. I just don't want to do it anymore. It sucks.
I'm with her. It's dumb to quit being a lawyer. I'm majoring in pre-law myself.
Oh, no. Bad idea, trust me. Being a lawyer is the worst. Now stand back and let me tell you my tale of woe.
So occasionally somebody would advocate for a genre, but it was really more driven by the, and there were so many songs that we covered a lot of stuff.
I think the goal was to always make a show that not only I'd want to watch, but my friends who don't like musical theater, who I was trying to convert to musical theater, would want to watch. And that helped that, I mean, Aileen to a lesser extent is kind of one of those people, but to a greater extent, Adam Schlesinger and Jack Dolgen, especially Jack Dolgen, who's been my songwriting partner for 10 years, everything needs to pass the smell test with Jack of like, is this just going to be like musical theater kid, or is this us like honoring something while taking
I have to tell, when we did the musical theater, the community theater episode, yeah. And they had to write like many, many musical theater parodies. It took no time. It would be like Rachel and Jack just had to do it, and it was like, okay, I'm going to write a dumb musical theater song, and then they would come back 5 minutes later. I mean, Apple Man, which is the dumbest song ever written, that I think Jack wrote in 10 minutes.
Jack wrote Apple Man in 10 minutes. It's the catchiest song we've ever done.
I'm going to do questions. I don't know if there's a microphone out there, so I'll repeat your question.
Yes, back there.
Oh, there is one. It's right here, if you want to come down. There's one right there, too. I see them now. Come on down.
When you were first starting out with the show, if you faced any challenges with blending two different genres, like a musical comedy with all original songs, was there anything that y'all faced when you were first starting to develop it?
I sometimes look back on those notes from the first meeting, and Rachel and I are just like bopping, and I put up the cards. Like, we really, genre-wise and taste-wise, we kind of knew where we were. I do remember when we started writing it, we did a two-week room with Michael and Aaron, who you see, who were like the senior members of the writer's room. The four of us did a room, and I remember it really dawning on you that you were going to have to write all those songs. Like, because, I'll tell you why, because we had written the second and third episode, and the second episode had a very filthy song that we could not use, and it was like seeing Rachel realize, oh God, we're on the CW, this song, which is so good, needs to be rewritten from scratch because it's too dirty. And I remember, I was sitting on the floor of the office, and I remember you just standing there being like, oh my God, I'm going to have to write a new song for this and for every episode, on and on and on and on and on. That was always the biggest challenge, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and I should say we were a pilot with Showtime. Showtime ordered a couple backup scripts from us, so we had what ended up becoming episodes 2 and then 12 written-ish. And so that's the dirty song. And then the way we wrote the dialogue of the pilot, I mean, I think that the big tonal question wasn't the music videos, because I'd been making those online, and it wasn't the structure and what we wanted to say, because Alina and I had figured that out. It was literally, what's the tone of the dialogue? What's the tone of the scenes? And we just kind of figured that out with Alina at the computer, me kind of like walking around the room and riffing or whatever, and we kind of wrote every line of the pilot together. And so that really was
the tone. We wrote
every
line of those first three episodes together in an office. And all the episodes that you see Rachel and I credited on were written together. Most of them were written together in a room. That's how our process was. And so it actually lended itself decently to transitioning into a writer's room, because I had been talking out loud to somebody, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But that was the biggest challenge. It was just getting that many songs written. No one's ever done it before. I don't think anyone will ever do it again. I wouldn't advise it.
Was there any personal reasons why you guys decided to make it a TV show rather than a movie? And if you know, how often you've thanked yourself for, thank God we made the TV show, and please make a movie.
When I saw Rachel's videos, we had that meeting. We met at CBS Television.
No, you had an idea for a movie called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. That was like a movie that you'd, I don't know if you developed it.
I just was an idea and a title, and I couldn't figure it out. But it was always a TV show, because I think also because Rachel's stuff was episodic and periodic. We've talked about other movie stuff, but this just seemed like a TV show and also an opportunity. We were also big fans of like Breaking Bad, and we wanted to do a big, long, kind of sweeping Rebecca Bunch epic. Look, young women deserve that, you know? A young woman deserves that much of a big 60-episode journey, and that's what she got.
And also, it's weirdly easier to pitch a TV show than it is to get a movie made. I mean, especially like on the scale that we would have needed to get this made. Like, I mean, it was... People had just started to make, had been making TV shows with unknowns as the lead, as kind of like comedy co-creators or whatever. But movies, you need an awful lot of money, and most movies don't get made. Movie business is a nightmare.
You spoke a little bit about having to change some songs, but was there ever times where you were like, no, like, we're keeping it this way? Were
they in response to notes?
Yeah, like if the CW like pushed back and was, or anybody was like, oh, maybe don't do this one, were you like, no?
They didn't. The only pushback, the CW, because we had a ready-made pilot when they saw it, they knew what we were going for. I mean, we got maybe a little pushback in the beginning when we did our first episode about depression, just because it was something that had truly never been done really on TV much, let alone the CW. But other than that, they trusted us tonally. The hardest part was standards and practices. So that was always just them trying to avoid getting a fine by the FCC. That was the hardest part.
Yeah. But in terms of breaking the rules, I learned a lot from Rachel because she's a real out-of-the-box thinker. And so for different reasons, she and I are both people who like to zig and when you're supposed to zag. And that was one of the things that we shared in common was like if something came up that seemed like the expected idea, we both sort of at different times would have. And that's really the essence of those videos is a joke you haven't thought of. They work, that's when I think they work best, you know.
When you started writing the series, did you have the borderline diagnosis for Rebecca in mind, or when did that come about?
You know, we just wrote her how it felt to us and what felt consistent. I think Rachel knew more about borderline than I did, so she suspected before I did. But we were writing this character just true to the character, and then when we decided to explore the diagnosis, Rachel had a pretty good idea that that's what it was. We gave episodes to multiple mental health professionals to say, this is what we suspect, does this seem right to you? And, you know, it turned out that we really had been depicting many, many things that were the diagnosis, and then we bought a lot of books, and the writer's room read a lot of books, and the episode where she gets the diagnosis was, we heavily researched all of that stuff to make sure that it was okay, but it did really emanate.
It's my belief that while you do have some symptoms of anxiety, depression, OCD, and possibly PTSD.
Right, but I've heard all those things before and you said this was a new thing.
I'm still talking.
Sorry.
It is my opinion that you exhibit many of the characteristics of borderline personality disorder.
Wow. Oh, okay. First question, what is that?
Well, a person with BPD is essentially someone who has difficulty regulating their emotions. Someone that lacks the protective emotional skin to feel comfortable in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a mix of us writing tropey things. You know, like when you think of movies like Fatal Attraction or Swim Fan, or even then in just musical theater, like Doing Anything for Love. Putting her in situations that felt tropey and then going beneath that. But if someone is, and then it was also a mix of like stuff that had maybe occurred to us to do with being obsessed with love but had never done. And so we were like, well, what if we just went one step further and had her do that? And so because it was almost like the narrative had to then be justified by the character's emotions, it just began to coalesce that, okay, if you were to actually look into why is this person doing what she's doing to fit all these different narrative forms? I mean, like episode 304 is our version of a horror movie mixed with Fatal Attraction, and it was us kind of going from the outside in with those tropes. You then have to think, okay, so if someone is actually doing those movie tropes, something is very wrong.
God, you know, I do love Erica Christensen, though.
Right?
Oh, my God, she's so good in the movie Swim Fan.
Yeah.
I just recently watched it, like, 8 times, and I saw the director's cut with 20 minutes more swimming.
What?
It's amazing, and Erica Christensen just kicks ass in that movie.
Oh, yes. His biggest fan just became his worst nightmare.
Yes, yes, oh, my God. Erica Christensen is so strong and brave in that movie. I mean, I know she's technically the villain and a murderer, but you know what? She is treated so unfairly.
Yes.
Like, he tells her that he cares about her and then casts her aside like she's garbage. I mean, I totally get it. It's how my ex is treating me right now.
Borderline is just a heightened version of how we all feel. They call borderline, when people who have borderline, it's like people who have emotional third-degree burns. There's no emotional skin. But it's very, people with borderline are also often seen to be almost psychic because they can read other people so well. And so this idea of a heightened version of things that had occurred to us makes a lot of sense with that diagnosis.
I wanted to ask Katie, was there something that being on the set and working on a documentary about this show and what the show brought out that changed maybe the way that you had made a documentary before? Did you learn something new that you put into this process?
I felt like I was just standing witness because the process had already been so developed and they were in their final moments. And so much was going on between shooting the episode prior to the finale, while prepping for the finale, songwriting, choreography, inventing new ideas like 2 days before shooting kind of stuff. And I just feel like I stood witness, whereas on other other things, I might have come in with trying to develop some ideas to like ask you guys to do some things for me. And it just didn't seem like the time to have, it was more like I wanted it to feel like a fly on the wall so that the audience could also feel that way too, where it's really just a portal.
It became Katie. This nice love letter send off too, and that had to have come across and became the new shape of things.
The documentary idea was something that Aline and I really had to force into existence. The whole show was kind of explaining to these big bureaucracies we were working for, like, this is what we want to do, because we were always kind of coming from an indie filmmaker, almost like YouTuber approach, and that's just like not what CBS and the CW necessarily do. And so Katie was a real drooper.
And I knew she could do it. I mean, I don't know that we would have made it if we had had, there was no way we had time to like interview filmmakers or think about it. It was just really one of the reasons it was in my head was because I knew Katie and I knew how talented she was.
If someone wanted to see this again, where do you see this?
Well, that's a good question. So in keeping with our dance with corporations, it was on CW Seed. It's not anymore.
Really?
Yeah, we need to talk about this. We'll try and make it available somehow, some way on Rachel's YouTube is the dream.
You know, you guys were making the show for 4 years, and you've been living with these characters for so long, and I'm curious whether Rebecca's journey of discovery informed your own life journey or taught you anything about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ending of the show was always, this is a song I wrote. That was always the last line of the entire, spoiler alert, that was always the last line of the series.
Romantic love is not an ending. Not for me or for anyone else here. It's just a part of your story, a part of who you are. And so, here we go. This is a song I wrote.
The show was ultimately about what's gonna make you happy, not what you think should make you happy, what's gonna make you happy. And I actually, it's my one tattoo. I have it on my thigh to remind me of quoting ourselves on my body seems like gross, but it's to remind me of, like, you know, practice what I preach. Like, we talked about a character who made her own destiny and made her own truth and did what made her happy, and it's something that I always want to remember for myself.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Story is supported in part by DePaul University's School of Cinematic Arts. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Maya Perez, and Katie Turner. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.